and welcome. I'm Alex Shahidi, and this is the Evoke 20-Minute Market Outlook podcast, where we share our thoughts about the current economic and market environment. Thank you for joining us today, and please feel free to visit our website at evokeadvisors.com for a PDF version of our quarterly outlook and to learn more about our firm. Welcome to the second quarter 2024 market outlook. As usual, I'm joined by Damien Basserier and Michael Marco. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Alex.
Good to be with you, Alex.
Damien, let's start with you. Would you begin with our high-level economic backdrop?
Happy to. It's always helpful to go back in time a bit in terms of what's happening today. So as we came into the year, markets had a very strong rally in November and December on the back of the Fed discussing their intention to lower interest rates this year. So basically, the markets were anticipating an end of the tightening cycle and a beginning of the easing cycle, which was a tailwind for all assets. And so we had a nice fourth quarter return from most asset markets, bonds, stocks, most notably. As we came into this year, you know, we have continued to expect an economy that would face some headwinds from higher interest rates. But frankly, we haven't seen that yet. You know, the economy has remained resilient. And in fact, in many senses, it's started to reaccelerate a bit. The labor markets are very strong. Inflation, which had been coming down very steadily over the course of last year, has seemed to level off and in fact, in some ways, increase a bit. Oil prices are up. Wage pressures have remained high, much higher than the Fed 2% inflation target. The first quarter, I'd say, is generally a story of resilient growth and inflation being a bit stickier than the Fed would desire. And as a result, as we came into the beginning of the year, the markets were expecting the Fed to cut 6 times. The Fed said they were going to cut 3 times this year. And now the markets are more or less agreeing with the Fed in terms of the 3 cuts. And there are now legitimate questions around whether they'll cut at all. And so that's been a little bit of a headwind for bonds. So bonds were a bit negative in the first quarter, but the resilient economy has actually been pretty positive for stocks. And you had a very strong quarter for stocks. And that's been aided as well by continuing euphoria around things like AI. So the notable names that outperformed last year, like NVIDIA and Meta, continue to outperform this year. Although it's probably not a Magnificent Seven anymore. Maybe it's more like the Big Four. But that's essentially what's been happening this quarter.
Damien, you talked about growth remaining resilient. I remember a year or so ago, there was a famous survey of economists. I think Bloomberg did that. And 100% of them said there's going to be a recession. And this was in 2023. So a year plus later, growth still has held up reasonably well. Why don't we dig in a little bit on growth and maybe some of the reasons why it's held up?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we wrestle with it a lot. I'm definitely going to want to get Michael's take as well on this question. I think some of the big factors that have led growth to being more resilient is that this has largely been an income-driven recovery. If you think back to the recovery from COVID, balance sheets, both household and corporate balance sheets, were as healthy as they've ever been because of all the stimulus. And you've had a very strong labor market. And so wages have been rising and generally people are employed. And so, you know, in past cycles, the impact of rising interest rates was much more pronounced because the source of spending was debt. And in this case, the source of spending is income, which has continued to increase. So I think that has softened the blow a bit. And if you think about the debt that is outstanding, it's largely been termed out with low interest rates. So most people have low interest rate mortgages, which are in place for an extended period of time, as corporates have also very logically termed out their debt during the 2020 and 21 period, where they were able to refinance and lock in low interest rates for long periods of time. And so you don't have the flow through in this economy, in the US economy, like you do in some other places where there's more floating rate debt, like the UK and Canada, that have slowed. So that's also been an impact. There's also been an unusual amount of fiscal stimulus for a growing economy. So normally you get a lot of fiscal stimulus in a weak economy. We've continued to get a lot of fiscal stimulus with big budget deficits, you had the IRA and the CHIPS Act and all of this government support for the economy. And that has also, I think, been supportive of growth. So those have been probably the primary things. I don't know, Michael, if you'd like to add something.
I mean, I think you really covered it. The one other piece of the picture, I think, is also what happened with inflation. And you had a lot of kind of one-off episodes due to COVID, a lot of the supply chain bottlenecks and the Russia-Ukraine war, different impulses. And also, of course, on the labor side, a lot of people not working, that driving wages much higher. All of those things kind of reversing somewhat for idiosyncratic reasons at similar times and helping to kind of bring inflation back down in a quick way that was kind of unexpected, and letting the Fed pivot, or at least, you know, directionally announce that it felt that it had, you know, was more or less accomplishing what it had intended to do in terms of slowing inflation much sooner than might have otherwise been expected.
The soft landing. That's at least what's been happening so far. We'll see, though. That's a tough thing to engineer.
One of the dynamics I think will be really interesting to keep an eye on is the Fed's reaction function. And if you kind of just go back even a couple decades, you know, you had a recession, the Fed is a little slow to respond, you get a downturn, and then they respond and get a recovery. So that's, think about 2002, it took a while until stimulus kicked in. And then 08, 09, it was a little bit more quick. COVID, it happened in a matter of weeks. Silicon Valley Bank, a matter of days. And it seems like when the Fed comes in to save the day, they've been doing it faster and more powerfully. And the dynamic to watch is what happens when they can't really do that freely without having to worry about stoking inflation. And that, I think, is just something we really have to keep an eye on, because that can really change the dynamics looking forward compared to looking backwards. So on that note, why don't we shift to inflation? Damien, you mentioned earlier that inflation has been stickier than expected. It hasn't come down to the Fed's target. Why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I think there's a few factors there. One is obviously wages, which have continued to grow at roughly 5% a year. And that's clearly a function of a strong labor market. Another would be a firming up of commodity prices. So you've seen gold and oil and other commodity prices rise. That was a big help for inflation last year as those prices fell. And so if there's now a sustainable turn in those prices, which, you know, we're not sure where they're going, but if it's sustainable, then that's obviously an upward pressure on inflation. You also have a situation where, and this, you know, I think makes the picture a little murky, is you have a lot of influx of new labor. So even though you've been adding a lot of jobs, you've actually seen the unemployment rate tick up a little bit. You could have a situation where more labor puts some downward pressure on inflation, just because, you know, we have been growing the population at a pretty unprecedented clip, you know, at least certainly in recent decade or two. Also, you have the impact of technology, which is very deflationary. You think about the potential impact of AI and how many jobs could over time go away. It's probably not an immediate impact, but in general, technology is deflationary for the economy. And so that probably isn't going away. You have a situation globally where supply chains are getting reoriented away from, in many cases, what was the lowest cost producer in China to elsewhere, or to more friendlier regimes that may be more costly in terms of producing things. So that also may create a slightly higher, longer term rate of inflation than what we've experienced over the last couple of decades as you've brought China online and leveraged very inexpensive labor. So it's a murky picture. I think the Fed is being appropriately cautious around wanting to see proof that inflation has reliably come down. But at the same time, I think they're also very acutely aware of the impact of higher interest rates. If interest rates really are higher than they need to be, and today you have pretty high real yields, which is the difference between the nominal interest rate and the inflation rate, those real yields are, you know, at the upper end of the range over the last 20 years. And they may not need to be so tight if inflation keeps coming down. Effectively, inflation coming down, if they keep rates where they are, means real yields are going up, and it means they're getting tighter implicitly. And so if inflation does sort of come down closer to that 2% target this year, they're very likely to ease, even if there's no growth disruption. because they're trying to sort of balance those two considerations, which is, you know, not unduly cause a recession, but at the same time, make sure you remain tough on inflation and don't allow it to become entrenched.
And inflation that is the market is discounting is relatively low. Michael, what are your thoughts about that and where the risks lie in terms of inflation coming in higher or lower than what's expected?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think Damien laid out a lot of the inflationary picture. I think some of those dynamics like AI and kind of the influx of labor, to some degree, those are longer term dynamics, particularly the technology one, as Damien mentioned. You know, you look at the TIPS market, the market for Treasury inflation protected securities, and that and the difference between the nominals, you see break-even rates at around 2.3% today for 10-year average inflation expectations. You know, you do have, I think, meaningful risks of an upside surprise, especially there's one kind of piece of the picture that maybe we haven't talked about yet, which is just the global growth picture. You know, for a while now, one thing that's been, I think, helping keep inflation somewhat in check and not, you know, cause a rebound has been slowing growth globally in the UK, Europe, Canada, China, especially. And, you know, all of those trends seem to be reversing growth. It's not like growth is robust in those regions, but it does seem to be turning and picking up. And China at least has indicated that kind of a willingness and interest in easing conditions to stimulate its economy again. And so to the extent that that causes global demand to pick up, it could also put upward pressure on prices generally, and particularly commodity prices. And, you know, with the ongoing conflicts we have in the Middle East and Russia and so on, the low inventories we have for oil, and it seems like the risks of an upside surprise are pretty significant.
Given the resilience and growth, it appears that there may be some irrational exuberance in some markets. Would you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think kind of that's even feeding into the inflationary picture as well, because there's kind of a self-reinforcing effect of financial assets leading people to, you know, when those rally, people feel wealthier, they feel more willing to spend. That spending flows through to kind of companies' revenues and kind of reinforces that exuberance. So, you know, and you've seen that, I think Damien mentioned some of these things. The Magnificent Seven stocks, you know, has doubled over the past year and a quarter. Momentum stocks have been outperforming by their widest margin since 2008. You've had growth dramatically outperform value stocks, about 32% or so. And so you've had kind of different pockets of the market. And I guess certainly worth mentioning Bitcoin, which is up more than 3x to, you know, last I looked, 70,000 or so. You know, Bitcoin has rallied tremendously. So you're sort of starting to see the speculative fervor picking up steam, kind of similar to what we saw in 2021. And I can't help but think that the Fed is also seeing that and perhaps somewhat concerned about that. You know, you see that spill over into the equity market at large, where potentially where you have forward priced earnings multiples at 22, which is, you know, very high relative to history, and particularly when you're in a period that of fairly robust growth and earnings growth. It's not like you're emerging from depressed earnings picture. So that would justify a higher forward PE.
Well, why don't we transition to some risks that we are contemplating given this backdrop that we just walked through?
I think the biggest risk is that the Fed not only doesn't ease, but potentially has to tighten in the face of this. They are very focused on getting inflation down. As long as growth is strong and you have this type of economy, they do have room to tighten if they have to. I don't think they're there now, but that is definitely not priced into asset prices, and I think would be a headwind for nearly everything, as we saw, you know, the last time they tightened in 2022 and into 23. So that's, I think, one big risk. The geopolitical risk, I think, is the biggest in certainly in my lifetime, in terms of just the tension, the global tensions that exist. You know, you have a lot of the major powers in the world not really working well together, and that is problematic. I think you have a lot of political polarization inside the United States, which is also problematic. You know, a government is really not getting anything done effectively, and that's you know, that's something that we worry about as well. Longer term for the US, the deficits are not sustainable. If you look at the path that we're on, that doesn't end well typically. You know, that creates, I think, a longer term risk around the dollar and inflation that you'd have to be cognizant of. And so there are a lot of things, you know, even though the markets are doing well and generally risk is perceived to be low, you know, credit spreads as well are very tight right now. We think there's a lot of risk under the surface. And it's very hard to predict a lot of these things I'm talking about. So we believe diversification is still very important. You and I have talked about this, Alex, that there's been this bear market in diversification over the last 10 years because the best thing you could have done is concentrate your portfolio in US stocks, which is more of the conventional approach. And really, if you've done anything else besides that, you've had worse returns. And generally, a lot of the assets that you might consider holding have done quite poorly over the last decade. You know, bonds have done very poorly. Non-US stocks have done poorly. Commodities have done poorly. That, I think, is understandably leading many investors to say that diversification is not working and, you know, we should just buy these great companies in the S&P 500. And it's very logical as a response. You know, it's low cost. It's the conventional approach. It's done well. The problem is that it's done much better than the average over the long term. And so, and it's not sustainably going to deliver, you know, 15% a year long term. You know, we already talked about the valuations and there's a lot of risk today in concentrating in anything, not just US stocks, but in any one thing because of the uncertainty from a macro perspective. So we believe that diversification really still is something that we would emphasize as an investment approach.
One of the biggest risks also is just the fact that expectations are so high and are so great. I mean, what we saw, I think, you know, back in 1999, 2000, the Fed was tightening, but what really, I think the consensus as to what really caused the market to crash was just the reality of earnings disappointing relative to extremely aggressive expectations that were just totally unrealistic in the internet bubble. And we're not at the same place today, but you can kind of start to see similarities in terms of how high expectations are for continued double-digit earnings growth at the same time as a lot of tailwinds for earnings that you had in the past couple of decades are either not there or have reversed in terms of falling interest rates, not falling, now actually being higher than they were, in terms of tax rates not falling anymore, potentially resetting to higher levels, in terms of labor market and margins, though that was also a tailwind as margins, profit margins expanded a lot. And now you have kind of labor pressures with higher wages potentially putting downward pressure on margins. And so when the economy as a whole is expected to grow, you know, in the 5% range, maybe even at best, having expectations of continued double-digit earnings growth where stocks are just taking share of profits from other sectors of the economy seems potentially too good to be true and somewhat unrealistic. And so I think those valuations themselves are a risk as well.
One thing that's interesting about the current environment, though, is that it's not universally great for everything. There's a lot of dispersion globally across regions, within the US, across different market caps, different types of stocks. You know, Michael already mentioned value versus growth. And so I think in the current environment, you have tremendous opportunity to add value, to take advantage of some of these overreactions, positive and negative. And there are sectors in the economy, for instance, that are in a real recession, like commercial real estate. So it's not universally euphoric. In fact, I think there's probably a higher than average level of dispersion across different sectors, different countries, different types of investments, which creates a lot of opportunity for quality active management. And that's really across our platform, what we've tried to identify are best-in-class managers within public, within private markets that can add value, that can navigate around these types of dynamics. And that's something that we think investors can benefit a lot from in this current environment.
One of the lessons of studying market history is that markets are cyclical. They're reliably cyclical. The timing of those inflection points is very difficult to figure out in advance, but they are cyclical. And, you know, the markets that tend to do the best looking backwards oftentimes do the worst looking forwards as that cyclicality plays out and average returns are earned through time. And it's, I think it's helpful to go back to the long-term returns, zoom out a little bit, don't get overly concentrated in the thing that's done the best most recently. And that speaks to our conversation today about the benefits of being diversified and trying to minimize your risk of a significant loss. Damian, Michael, I appreciate your insights and I look forward to our conversation next quarter.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for listening to the Evoke 20-Minute Market Outlook podcast produced by Evoke Advisors. If you have questions, feel free to email us at info@evokeadvisors.com. And if you enjoy the discussion, please subscribe to this podcast to ensure you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to forward today's conversation to others you think would also enjoy listening. This quarterly podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Evoke Advisors, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations nor reference past or potential profits. And listeners are reminded that securities trading, commodity trading, and alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.